I mean to say leadership leads. And we, Christians, are supposed to lead people to Christ by living as much like Christ as we can. You see, our study is the world against us in so many ways, pressing on us, trying to force us to cave into its ways and be back like them again. We all have a vulnerable spot in Achilles' heel, but we are still expected to show up in formation and ready for the struggle.
This is Cross Reference Radio with our pastor and teacher, Rick Gaston. Rick is the pastor of Calvary Chapel, Mechanicsville. Pastor Rick is currently teaching through the book of 1 John. Please stay with us after today's message to hear more information about Cross Reference Radio, specifically how you can get a free copy of this teaching. Today, Pastor Rick will be continuing his study called The World Against Us in 1 John chapter 2.
We are in John's first letter, chapter 2, if you have your Bibles with you. One of our roles in life as believers is to get as many people as we can to go marching in with the saints. And that takes a lot. We are going to take, again, 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17, if you would stand, please, that we could read together the Word of God. Verse 15. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. I have a lengthy introduction that I hope really captures for us one of the great lessons from this section of Scripture concerning the world against us. In this part two, just three verses with two parts. Unless I don't get through it this morning, then we'll have three parts. But man-made gods, there's nothing new about men making gods for themselves. Psalm 115, their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. And then in verse 8 of Psalm 115, those who make them are like them. So is everyone who trusts in them. There's a big problem concerning mankind. He's got this habit of, instead of being made in the image of God, receiving that, developing that, he has decided, lost man, to make God in his own image. And those who make them, writes the psalmist, are those who forge out ideas about God. The ancients used to have little statues and figurines and things. Today, it's more sophisticated than that as a rule in Western civilization. It's in the head. It's just the imagination. I think God is. Well, where'd you get that from? Well, I made it up. Or I listened to someone else who made it up. It's more carnal inspiration or natural inspiration, fallen inspiration, as opposed to divine revelation. They're not getting this information from the throne of the only true God. They're concocting it based on their experiences as human beings. So men try to create God in their puny image, and you can't tell them no. The prophets dealt with this. Isaiah hammered it. Jeremiah hammered it. Ezekiel, you know, when we studied Ezekiel, he was a little eccentric. Ezekiel called them dung gods. That's the Hebrew. He was just so not interested in what wrong people had to say about the true God. The psalmist says they are like them. That is dead and blind, because that's what the statues were that they fashioned with their tools. Undiscerning, impotent, lame, inexpressive of God's truth, an offense to God. The gods of the Greeks, their mythology that we know it now, but at one time, people actually believed these things. Those gods were concocted by sinners, and they simply transferred their attributes, their characteristics, to the gods that they made up. They were vile, vindictive, lustful, jealous, violent, rude, obnoxious, lustful, I said lustful, and they were also lustful. Murderous, they were rotten. Human beings with superpowers,
carnality on steroids. Those were the gods of the Greeks. And the Romans so fell in love with them after they conquered the Greeks that they took them to be their gods and named them. Instead of Zeus, it's Jupiter now. And down the list goes. Those fallen attributes of humanity baked into these imaginary gods, fulfilling what the prophet said in Psalms. Those who make them are like them, so is everyone who trusts in them. You cannot make God in your own image and expect him to be unlike you. And what is so redeeming about you that you'd want a God to have these characteristics? We'll get to why that was so rejected by those who came to Christ because of the preaching of the apostles and the disciples of God. They wanted so out from these fake gods that when Christ came along, I got ahead of myself, when Christ came along, they just embraced him, so many of them. So is everyone who trusts in them. In both cases, if you're going to be like the gods you make, dead. That's what you're going to be. That's what you get in the end. Hell gives you nothing back. It just takes everything from you. Such gods drag down their worshipers to the same level of their senseless stupidity and dumbness. Which brings us to how it all shows up in human literature. Homer's Iliad is a marvelous illustration of humanity getting it as far as the problem of humanity. Homer illustrates for us that human beings understand the problems. They just don't have the solutions. As Homer develops his Iliad, it is a magnificent display, as I mentioned, of humanity understanding the problem. Fallen, unsavory behavior of humanity, of men, sin, carnality, but I'm not really calling it sin, not according to the definitions of God. It is, Greek mythology is a caricature on the world, and it starts off with contention. When he starts writing, it's the contention between Agamemnon, the great king, and Achilles, the great war hero. A man starts his story with contention. He doesn't understand the peace of God. And we ourselves who are saved, we struggle to capture that peace in this violent world, violent against the truths of God. Greek mythology is a soap opera. It never ends. They just keep building the story. It never satisfies. It's a Frankenstein. It's got a part here and a part there until you have this monster walking around. It's fascinating soap opera, I should add. It includes humanistic psychology. Man looking at man. Again, no solutions. Just man looking at man, amplifying his behavior. This compelling story, it is compelling. It is compelling because we see ourselves in it. We see mankind. We say, this is how they act. It's illustrated in the Trojan War that he writes into this Iliad. Now, evidently, there was a Trojan War. Those of the great city Troy versus the Greeks, the Athenians, the Spartans, and all their satellite countries and neighbors that were around them converging on Troy, having this war. Homer saw an opportunity to tell a great story, and he brings his gods into the story because it captures our imagination very easily. In his story, he really gets to the end of the siege of Troy. It was a 10-year war, and in the ninth year, it's the story. That's where the story begins. You know the story. The Trojan horse goes into the city. The soldiers are hiding in it, and they jump out. Do you know how it started in his story? How Homer says, let me tell you how this war started. Of course, he throws into it this mythology that's very exciting. It started with a marriage celebration. A king and a goddess were to marry each other. And all the goddesses were invited, and all the gods were invited, and all of the celebrities and the big shots of those day were invited, except one goddess, Eris, the goddess of discord. She was stopped at the gate by another of the gods, Hermes. But she leaves a wedding gift. She throws in a golden apple. And written on the golden apple is, to the most beautiful. Well, Hera, the other one of the goddesses, she says, that's mine. So did Aphrodite and Athena. You see Homer's capturing this vanity, this jealousy, this desire to be the best, the most beautiful. And it starts now with a beauty contest. It then moves to a beauty contest. So they go to Zeus, who is a a rotten god took the throne from his own father. What kind of nonsense is in that? Well, anyway, Zeus says, I don't want any part of it because the story has politics in it. He knows better. So he says to the prince of Troy, Paris, I want you to decide which of the three goddesses is the most beautiful so we can settle this whole mess. So he arranges a beauty contest, and the goddesses bribe him. Now remember, this is a man-made story, and what I'm trying to illustrate is that man sees the problems in humanity, and we do too. The difference is we offer solutions. They don't. There's no solution to this story. So Paris is about to, he's judging the women, and Hera, the first goddess, she tries to bribe him, and so does Athena. One offers him all of Asia and all of Europe to be his kingdom. How could he say no to that? Another one offers him to be the greatest warrior and sage of all time. Sort of a Samson-Solomon thing going on there. But Aphrodite offers him the most beautiful woman on earth. He picks that one. But she leaves out an important part. She's already married. So what does he do? He's got the bug now. He wants her. He goes to Greece and he steals her from Menelaus, the king, the brother of Agamemnon. Anyway, Menelaus loses his wife to Paris, steals her, and then he goes to his brother and he says, we have a pact to protect each other. You have to help me. And they raise this gigantic army. Menelaus, incidentally, is the king of the Spartans. Now, you don't want to mess with those guys. They have leather jackets on and, you know, Sparta, Greece, you know, bad dudes. So, of course, they go to attack Troy, and that's where the Trojan War begins. Over a beauty contest, over vanity, over discord, over another man's wife, then comes to the front Achilles, the greatest warrior of all. Now we're getting closer to ourselves. Homer does a brilliant job bringing out humanity with Achilles. Achilles fights Hector, the great champion of Troy, and he defeats him. No one can beat Achilles. But Paris, the one who was to judge the three goddesses, the prince of Troy, he takes an arrow and he fires it, and he gets Achilles in the heel. We know it as the Achilles heel to this day. And it brought down the most valiant warrior of all, Achilles, with one arrow. In the most unlikely place. You would think a headshot would have done it. A heart shot. The ankle? The bottom of the foot? Well, how do you protect that part? How do you move without it? It's actually brilliant. Homer has captured something about humanity. It's the point of weakness in all of us. We all have one. Even the greatest person has a point of weakness. It is the flesh. It's where the sin resides. It is the port of entry, that point of contact. A person can be otherwise strong, powerful, mighty, have so many glorious attributes, but they've got a weak spot. There's an Achilles heel there somewhere. Of course, we've named that tendon after Achilles to this day. And so the Greeks in Homer and those who followed and built upon the stories, they clearly express inescapable truths about us. Mankind cannot imagine mankind sinless on his own. You need God to do that. Even in their stories, they get to Hades and the underworld, to Tartarus, and it is a mess down there, unlike the heaven that our God promises us. Even the poor atheist has a God. Because whatever really is the controlling influence in your life is God to you. And the atheist has concocted his own ideas. No one else is dedicated to proving that something that they don't believe exists doesn't exist. It's the kookiest thing. A bunch of us are going to get together and we're going to rail against fairies. We know they don't exist. We're going to march on Washington to prove it. Anyway, pop psychology illustrates for us now in modern times without the Greek mythology that man is still identifying problems without solutions. It's very easy. They give them all sorts of fancy names, codify it, write down all the characteristics and traits, and offer you a therapy that never ends. Many times they create the sicknesses they claim to treat. They don't even exist. Feeling down, buddy? You need a pill. Wait a minute. Depression is part of life. And faith is part of overcoming those things. And it's hard. And if you're having this issue, I'm not picking on you. I'm pointing it out. You're loved very much by God nonetheless. If you were to go to your cardiologist and say, you know what, I feel a little funny in my heart. Can you give me a few pills? He would say, no way. It's illegal. But in this field, you can say, I don't feel too good today. Here you go. See, there's a problem. And we're supposed to be able to identify it. Because anybody that claims to deal with human behavior from a Christian perspective is dealing with sin, whether they know it or not, and we're here to point it out. It's a sin issue. We're fallen beings. We need God to help us through these things. And even as he helps us, it is a brutal fight. It is an Achilles versus Hector. It is a Hector versus Ajax. It is an awful fight, even with faith. And anybody that thinks because you've got Jesus Christ, you're not going to fight, you are wrong. Because we're all tied in together, and we all have loved ones, and life and sin do not cooperate with the ideal of the faith we have. Until we get to heaven, there is no peace. Christianity is supposed to be different than everything else under the sun. And in that ancient world, those people that were worshiping the Zeus and the Mercuries and all the other junk that was out there, the Aphrodites, when they heard the gospel of Christ, they couldn't wait to get out, many of them. They no longer wanted these grotesque images of gods. They wanted a God that was clean and pure and loving and not vindictive and petty and violent and lustful. Christianity is supposed to still be offering something that is attractive and beautiful. The church is supposed to be like an army with banners, mighty and attractive. She is supposed to be a bride. I never saw an ugly bride. Well, there was one time. She was so ugly, they kissed the groom. I went, okay, it's a fake story. Some of you are really touchy here. Like, don't be messing with the bride and the women. But in reality, I mean, it's kind of funny. We'll kiss the groom instead. But the brides, they're dolled up, you could say. They've taken the time. The church is supposed to be this. But so often we're fighting each other, petty. You said Moses, not Noah. Well, Moses did have an ark. It was a toy ark. It was a little boy, and he played with it. And floated on water to old Pharaoh's daughter, and she fished him out of the Nile. Well, anyway, back to the church. The church does more for the world when the church is least like the world, said G. Campbell Morgan, one of my favorite writers, well, preachers, I should say, pastors. So it is true with individuals. We are more helpful as individuals to those in the world when we're not like the people in the world. But Christianity does got this thing where they have to, you know, gravitate down. When I first was introduced to the Calvary movement, it was a group of people that I had come in touch with that were committed to following the book of Acts as best they could. And they really weren't looking at what other churches were doing. They were looking at the book of Acts. They were looking at all of the Bible, and it was so attractive to me to this day. It is this church is patterned after that, how we conduct business, Acts 2:42. But in time, of course, the next generations began to join, and they didn't have that attraction to the simplicity of the Scripture. They wanted it complicated, and many of them look outside. What are you doing so we can do it too? How do you do service so we can do it too? We used to blaze the trail. That's Christianity. Christianity should say to the world, I'm not asking you how to do this or where to go with my behavior and how I look at life and eternity and death and all these things. I'm not asking you how you do it. I'm telling you how it's done. And you take it or leave it. But when Christians look to the world, we start becoming like them. What do we have left to offer them? We become hybrids, demi-Christians. You know, when the king married the goddess and they had a child, which that whole thing refutes Genesis 6 wacky notion, I won't go into that. That was a demigod as a child, half God, half man. Christ was not half God, half man when he came through the virgin. He was all man in the flesh. He was all God in essence. Well, anyway, We do most for them when we are least like them morally and spiritually. I'm not coming up here with a tie on and a pair of nice sneakers so I can tell you I'm the pastor, but look, my sneakers tell you I identify with you. I'm not trying to appeal to anybody in that way. I am setting the pace. I am the leader. Leaders don't say, how should I lead? They lead to those following. You may say, that's arrogant. No, that's leadership. I can identify with the troubles and struggles. And we tell our youth, we're not trying to be 15 years old again. Look, do you ever see a guy in his 50s trying to look like he's 20? It's like, man, they got to catch up. That's my point. I probably was a little clumsy and harsh in saying it the first time, but that's the way it is. Anyway, I didn't mean it that way. It would be harsh. I mean to say leadership leads. And we, Christians, are supposed to lead people to Christ by living as much like Christ as we can. You see, our study is the world against us in so many ways, pressing on us, trying to force us to cave into its ways and be back like them again. We all have a vulnerable spot in Achilles' heel, but we are still expected to show up in formation and ready for the struggle. And so now we come to verse 16. We covered verse 15 last session, so we move to verse 16. And there he says, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. He just encapsulated all of Greek mythology, the gods that were not mythical to the people living at that time. Their gods were lustful and in the flesh and just proud and all these other problems. And so were the people, because the people were like the gods they made. And he says, tells us, for all that is in the world. Here is a love that God hates. God does not want his people to love the things that are in the world. Now, we will from time to time, but we know it and we struggle against it because it's appealing, many of the things that are here. We've got to learn how to strike that balance. I'll cover that a little bit more in a minute. But this world is the enemy of God. Does not the mainstream media reek of that? You can smell their hatred of Christ. In everything they do, they typify the world for us. James chapter 4, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. When you try to line up with them, let them dictate policy to you, tell you what to believe, how to do this and how to do that concerning spirituality and morality, then you've goofed up big. We want to chase what Christ wants us to have. Because chasing the Christless and Christlessness harms us. Mark's gospel, Jesus said, and we all know this one, all you believers know this one, for what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? So what? You crash into the mountain flying first class. You still crash into the mountain. And that's how death will be for those who insist on stiff-arming the gospel of Christ and the Jesus of the gospel. He says the lust of the flesh. Now that word for lust here can mean any strong desire, good or bad, but the context alerts us to its application. And of course, John here is talking about the unrighteous desires, the urges, the impulses. And they sneak up on us many times. We don't look for them, they find us. We discover that we have wants that we should not have, that are not good for us, they're not even good for those around us. And when we have these desideratums, we say, I must have it, I must have it. That's the lust of the flesh. And the Iliad, that story that I briefly covered in the Trojan War, it illustrates this for us. That whole thing was the lust of the flesh. And it had heroes and cowards. It had manipulators, politicians, lovers. Everything that makes for good reading, carnally speaking. So these exciting things of the world, they distract us. They dim our light. You remember the tabernacle in the wilderness had tools to keep the wicks burning brightly. So we need these things in our lives. The exciting things of this world, they do distract us. They do dim the light and they do cause damage rather than edifying and equipping us. And they do it very easily because we are born in iniquity.
Thanks for tuning in to Cross Reference Radio. Cross Reference is a ministry of Pastor Rick Gaston of Calvary Chapel, Mechanicsville, in Virginia. If you'd like to learn more about this ministry, we invite you to visit our website, crossreferenceradio.com. You'll find a number of teachings from Pastor Rick available there. We also encourage you to subscribe to our podcast. When you subscribe, you'll be notified of new editions of Cross Reference Radio. Just search for Cross Reference Radio in iTunes, Google Play Music, or your favorite podcast app store. You can also follow the links at crossreferenceradio.com. We're glad we were able to spend time with you today. Tune in next time to continue learning from the book of 1 John with Pastor Rick, right here on Cross Reference Radio.